5, starting in verse 21. And when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd had gathered about him, and he was beside the sea. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name. I have to get it in my reading zone. And seeing him, he fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." And he went with him. And a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. And there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years and who had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had and was no better but rather grew worse. She had heard the reports about Jesus and came behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, "If I touch even his garments, I will be made well." And immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." While he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they had said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. They came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and Jesus saw a communion of people weeping and wailing loudly. And when he had entered, he said to them, "Why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. But he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha kumi," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." And immediately the girl got up and began walking, for she was 12 years of age. And they were immediately overcome with amazement. And he strictly charged them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat.
Guess that was my cue. Will you guys go ahead and pray with me? Our Father, Lord, we are so grateful for the word that you have given us. We are grateful that you have gathered us together here this morning to gaze into your word, to hear what it has to say about your son who entered into creation with the express purpose of redeeming for himself a people to call his own, a people that he would use as a light to all nations and to continue to draw and to strengthen that people. So, Father, I ask that your spirit would be working in and amongst us this morning as we hear your word preached, and that you would just be protecting your sheep from any error that is within me. We pray all these things in Christ's name. Amen. Well, it sure is a pleasure and an honor to be able to come before you and to serve from this pulpit once again. And I admit that when I first saw Casey's message about what we were going to be talking about through the Advent season, I was really excited. Because while the nativity story in and of itself and what we normally think of the Christmas story is fantastic, it's wonderful, sometimes I feel like there are several themes that get so easily passed over. And one of those themes is exactly what Casey wanted us to talk about, which was the humility of Christ in his ordinary ministry and also how he cared for the people that he interacted with who were suffering. And I think when, you know, at first glance, this doesn't seem like a Christmas story, Mark chapter 5. This isn't a story about Jesus' birth. There's no discussion of shepherds and of angels or wise men or angry kings or of a virgin who bore the Son of God. But this is a story that reveals to us in some of the strongest ways why Jesus came. And I ask you, as we begin to take a look at this passage, how does the text do that? How is this information conveyed to us? What type of form does Mark 5 take? It's a story. It's a story. This is the narrative part of the gospel of Jesus' life. And I'm always amazed when I go back, and I've been reading through this passage again and again over the last several weeks, and it always strikes me as interesting that one of God's favorite way to communicate with you and me today is through stories. Now, when I say stories, I don't mean made-up stories. This is historical. This is factual. This actually happened. But yet, how do we come to learn about Jesus? It's through the written stories of how he lived and how he interacted with those around him. And it is how it is revealed to us, even before the cross, even before the resurrection. It tells us why he came. So with this in mind, let's go ahead, and I'm gonna read once again verses 21 through 24 as kind of the part one or the introduction to this story. It says, when Jesus had crossed over again in the boat to the other side, a large crowd gathered around him, and so he stayed by the seashore. And one of the synagogue officials named Jairus came up, and on seeing him, fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, my little daughter is at the point of death. Please, come lay your hands on her so that she will get well and live. And he went off with him, and a large crowd was following him and pressing in on him. So you will remember that this story right here, this picks up right where we left off last week. I was talking about Jesus' interaction with the man who was possessed. And so after that incident, and after Jesus had probably ruined the local economy by having 2,000 pigs go into the ocean, and they said, look, man, it's expensive to have you around here, so you need to go across the other side. So Jesus picks up, he goes over to the other side, and as he's getting off the boat, he's immediately contacted by someone. This person is introduced to us as Jairus, and it says that he was one of the synagogue officials. So as you guys probably are aware, the synagogue is the local covenant community center for the Old Testament Israel. So not everyone could travel throughout the length of Israel, and especially those Israelites that lived outside of the land of Israel at this time, couldn't travel to the temple on a regular basis to perform sacrificial rites, to hear the word of God preached, to listen to the law being read. And so they had these local bodies, which were called synagogues, which fulfilled that purpose. And at the synagogue, you had a couple of different kinds of workers. You had more of what we would call the clerical workers, who were the people who would get up and would read the law, who spent their entire time reading the Old Testament, studying the law of God, memorizing the law of God, and working that law of God out with its purpose being a light of nations to all that were around them. But you also had the people who were charged with the everyday functions of the synagogue. And that's most likely what Jairus is here. He's a synagogue official. We would probably use the term of administrative or executive pastor in our language today. But this is an important guy. This is a guy who's more than likely wealthy. Everyone in this town knows who he is. It sounds like he's one of the synagogue officials, so he's probably one of several, but he's still a high-standing member in the society. And I find it particularly interesting what he does. So Jesus comes over. He's already gained quite notoriety. This is after, you know, what Casey had preached about. He's healed a paralytic man. He's been teaching. He's been drawing large crowds. This is after he had kind of had a rough patch with the religious leaders of the day he did this terrible, terrible thing where he had the audacity to heal a man with a withered hand on the Sabbath. And that had just caused this whole uproar with the Pharisees and the Sadducees and all of those who were busy interpreting the law of God at that time. So he's pretty well known at this point. So he comes over from across the sea, and he gets off the boat, and there's already starting to form a crowd there. And the first person that comes up to him is one of the highest-ranking members of society. And what's the first thing he does? The first thing he does when he sees Jesus is he falls down before him. He fell at his feet. It's a sign of respect, but it's also implicates to us Jairus' situation. He's a man in crisis. He knows who Jesus is. He's heard stories about the paralytic that was healed. He's heard stories about Jesus' healing power. Maybe he had even heard at this point about Jesus casting out the demons. 2,000 pigs going to the ocean spreads pretty quick. So it's possible that news had already come back. And so a man in crisis, he said his daughter is sick and near death. This is a man that's beyond any hope at this point of his daughter being able to live. And here's Jesus, the man who has been able to heal those beyond healing. And he comes, and even though he is a religious leader, and remember that Jesus has already had some go-ins with the religious leader at this point, he shows the respect, falls down before him, and implores Jesus, please, please come. My daughter, she's sick. Come and lay your hands on her so that she might live. And Jesus doesn't need any further convincing beyond that. It says, and he went off with him, and a large crowd was following him and pressing on him. And here we get a break in this story. Some people call this the Markian sandwich, which is weird. But it's how Mark sometimes does parables, where he begins one story and he inserts another story in the middle of it before we get the full resolution of this story. So in the second part of this story, Mark introduces us to another character. He introduces us to a woman. And Mark doesn't tell us what her name is, but he does give us a hefty description of what this woman's life had been like up to this point. She is introduced to us as a woman with a hemorrhage for 12 years. What kind of hemorrhage? I'm not sure we're going to be able to completely diagnose the problem with complete certainty, but Mark's description of the hemorrhage is as a flow of blood, literally, flow of blood. And that terminology has convinced every commentator that I read that this woman was suffering from some form of prolonged uterine bleeding. And now this might come as a complete shock to some of you, but I'm actually not much of an expert on that topic. So you might reasonably ask me at this point, why would you bring this up? Why would the medical diagnosis be important? Isn't Jesus' interaction with her and the healing far more important than what is making her sick? And I would say to you that such an analysis would be tremendously important because of what is written in Leviticus chapter 15. Now, I know all of you were on the edge of your seats when Pastor Chris was going over Leviticus 15, and I know that I don't have to recount to you what was said in that passage. But in case there are any slackers like me out there who weren't paying attention when Chris was going over Leviticus 15, I'll go ahead and do a quick breakdown. If you want to read the particular section of Leviticus 15 that we're going to be talking about, it's Leviticus 15, 19 through 30. I'm not going to read it all right now, but I'll give you the Cliff Notes version. For the old covenant community, menstruation meant that you were unclean. And anything you touched or anything that touched you was also unclean and would have to have gone through purification rites, which are described in Leviticus 15, before it could come into common use again. And the same goes for the people. The woman who is menstruating would have to go through purification rites before she could return to normal old community life. And anyone who touched her during that time would also have to go through that same purification process. Leviticus says that this process normally only lasted 7 days before people had to go through the cleansing. But if for some reason the menstruation took longer than that, Leviticus says, and I quote in verse 25, now if a woman has a discharge of blood many days, not a period of her menstrual impurity, or if she has a discharge beyond that period, all the days of her impure discharge, she shall continue as in her menstrual impurity. She is unclean. Any bed on which she lies on all the days of her discharge shall be to her like the bed of menstruation, and everything on which she sits shall be unclean like her uncleanness at that time. Now, granted, that seems really weird to us, 2,000 years removed from old covenant life, but I want you to take a moment and apply what we've just read to Leviticus chapter 15 and put yourself in this woman's shoes. She's had this hemorrhage for 12 years. For 12 years, she has been unclean. Unclean, that means that you cannot be a participant in synagogue or temple life. 12 years being separated from the covenant community of God. For 12 years, her home or wherever she ate, wherever she slept, has been unclean. Think about how this would have limited her social interactions. No self-respecting Israelite at this time would have put himself or herself in a position where they might be made unclean, because then they're in that same position. They got to go through those same purification rites. So for this woman, she's been in 12 years of lawfully enforced isolation. She's probably at this point not even living in her home community any longer. She's probably living outside the camp. That's where the destitute, that's where the lepers are. That's where the people that no one wants to interact with, that's where the outcasts are. And at this time, this place, societal and communal living, it was all about the community. It was all about your family. It was all about the people that you live next to, your neighbors. This was important. Our modern ideas of self-sufficiency and independence are relatively new in the grand scheme of things and would have been entirely foreign to the first century world. There was no such thing as self-sufficiency. And if you think about it, there's really no such thing as self-sufficiency now, only a greater degree of it. But especially back then, people needed each other to survive. This woman is living on the fringe of society. And all that to say, this woman's life was nothing more than a living hell. Verse 26 shows us that she had done everything in her power to escape this illness. It says that she suffered much at the hands of physicians. And beyond this, that in trying to be rid of her illness and going to these physicians, that she had spent all that she had, all of her wealth, anything that she owned, was absorbed and used trying to be free, trying to flee from this illness. Today we would call her a victim of the system, unable to get the appropriate care or service and unable to be cured. And instead of these physicians making things better or even improving her quality of life a little bit, all they've done is made things worse. Instead of being healed, she's been debilitated. And for this woman, there is no end in sight from her physical suffering and societal isolation. She is, in every sense of the word, an outcast. But in verse 27, something dramatic happens. Look at how verse 27 begins. It says, after hearing about Jesus. That is where dramatic change takes place in her life. Up until now, she was confronted by a future of decline, separation, and death. But she heard about this man, this rabbi, this contentious teacher who had stirred up controversy by healing a man with a withered hand on the Sabbath. A man whose reputation for healing was so widespread by this point that some guys, after hearing that he was teaching in someone's house, came and chopped the man's roof off and lowered down their paralytic friend just so he could be healed. This was the one, the man who could surely and finally heal her. And whether she sought him out of some mystical idea that touching him would heal him or whatever, the fact of the matter is that she believed that this man could heal her. And when he showed up and she saw him, she knew that she had to attempt and try to get close to him. Now, it would seem Jesus' coming had created a ruckus, because as we've already read, as he was going along with Jairus, a crowd had formed around him. This seems to be a common thing already and definitely would continue to be a theme of Jesus' ministry, is when that he shows up, his fame is so widespread that people want to see him. People want to touch him. People want to talk to him. People want to hear him teach. And this woman knew that if she could just get close enough to lay a hand on Jesus, just to touch his cloak, that she would be healed. she would be clean. She would be free from the life that she had spent living. Take a minute to think about that. This is risky for her, going out in public. If people were to recognize her, if they knew who she was, she risks further shame and humiliation. She's an outcast. She doesn't belong in and amongst the people. She doesn't belong in the community. She is permanently unclean. But the possibility of Jesus being her final escape from her life of suffering and bondage is enough for her to risk it. So she's in the crowd. You can imagine that she's trying to keep a low profile. She's physically debilitated, and the crowd is pushing in and around Jesus. And so she's trying to get closer. She's trying to push in. She's touching people around her. She's terrified because she knows if they know who she is when she's rubbing up against him, that they are also, by the law's designation, by God's designation, they are also unclean. And as she's jostled to and fro, she finally gets close enough just to reach out. Just far enough to grab on to the edge of his cloak. And it says, immediately, she was made well. She knows that she is well. In an instant, she can physically tell the difference. Her body has been restored. Everything that she's tried to accomplish for the last 12 years, it's done. All the pain and the suffering she's experienced, it's over. But she's not the only one who's noticed the difference. The text says that Jesus knew that power had gone out from him. He knew that the Spirit had acted in and through him in that instant. So he turns to the disciples who are shielding him from all the bodies that are bustling around him. And they're probably forming some sort of human shield wall at that point, trying to keep some space between the crowd that's around him and Jesus. And so Jesus turns to him and he says, "Who touched my garments?" And just imagine being the disciples in that moment. You probably can barely hear him because of the crowd that's around him. And you're physically body blocking all these people. And Jesus turns around and says, "Hey man, who touched me?" And they're just like, "Dude, do you not see all of this? All these people that are around you? My best guess is it's probably one of them." But Jesus knew that power had gone out from him. Now I have no idea what that's supposed to mean. But my best guess is that Jesus knew that someone had touched him and had been restored. And my guess is that he knew exactly who it was. And he's putting on a little bit of a show to bring this woman out. And watch what happens here. So as he says it, he looks around at the crowd. And it says that he looks at the woman herself. Now imagine being that woman right now. You're an outcast. You took a big risk in even being a part of the crowd. Yes, you've been made well, but now Jesus has just made eye contact with you, and you've been found out. And even though you've been made well, you're still unclean by the law's designation. She hasn't gone through the purification rites, yes, and she's just touched Jesus. Heck, she's probably touched dozens of people as she's moved through the crowd, and they're now unclean. And even worse, this man, this rabbi, this teacher who knows the law so well, he's unclean too, according to the law, and it's her fault. So here she is. She's about to be outed, about to receive the shame and the humiliation her status deserved. But she does the right thing. And instead of slipping away back into the crowd, which is probably what I would have done at that point, she meets Jesus' stare. She comes forward trembling, it says. She's terrified. And she does exactly what Jairus had just done a little bit before. She falls down before him, just as Jairus had done, and told him the whole truth. She lays herself bare. She opens up about her illness, about the bleeding, about the physicians, about what she's endured. She tells him everything. You can just imagine the reaction of the crowds who are around her. They're disgusted. You can almost see them backing away, shaking their heads. "Oh, she touched me." Especially those who had bumped up against her, just freaking out. And as people start to move back, everyone waits to hear what Jesus is going to say. What is Jesus going to do? She hadn't followed the purification rites of the law that he knew so well. Surely he was going to chide her for her ignorance, for stepping out of bounds, for coming in and amongst the dwelling place of God's people. She was an outcast. She's unclean. Those people belonged outside the city, away from the community. So she waits for Jesus to speak. It's like when you're a kid and you know that you've done something wrong, and I can hear it so well in my head, that familiar sound. I'd be down in the basement and I could hear going down through the hallway, "Andrew Philip Esping, did you do such and such?" And you'd say, "Yeah, that was me." And you'd sit there and you'd look at that stare and you'd wait on the edge of your seat. And you would inwardly recoil as you prepared to hear what was going to be said. What was the criticism going to be? What's the punishment going to be? But what does Jesus say? Look at the first words in verse 34. After hearing her story, after looking at her, he looks at her and addresses her and he calls her daughter. This could have been the first time that this woman had received a lovingly and personal interaction in over 12 years. Hear and feel the tenderness in his voice. Imagine being this woman who is on the edge of collapse, near the point of tears, if not bawling already, enduring public humiliation, laying face down before a crowd of people at the feet of Jesus, and he reaches out to her and he calls to her like a father does to his child. "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace. Be healed of your affliction." I guarantee of all the things that she was prepared to hear in that moment, she was not prepared to hear that. That was the farthest thing from her mind. But here is what she probably didn't realize in that moment, that the Son of God cannot be made unclean. On the contrary, he came to make his people clean. Not only is this woman healed of her physical illness, but through faith in Jesus, she has been made clean, not just clean by the standards of the old covenant law, but been made clean enough to stand in the presence of God. So why does this matter? Why is this little side note, this little paragraph distraction from the larger story written down for us? Really, a lot can be said about Jesus and this woman's interaction. But what I want you to take note of is that this woman was a nobody. Jesus had nothing to gain by healing this woman, by taking time to speak with her and to encourage her. On the contrary, he probably could have gained some style points from the religious leaders at that time by shaming her, by making a spectacle and a mockery of her, for condemning her for making him unclean. But as we've already discussed, Jesus isn't concerned about the popular opinions of those around him. And this leads us to our first takeaway, our first point this morning, which is that Jesus came to restore the outcast. Of course, Jesus is concerned about the law. And his actions here are not at all to be interpreted as Jesus turning a blind eye to Leviticus 15. But the law's purpose in proclaiming someone as unclean was supposed to be more surreal than its mere application. Here's what I mean. Being unclean is more than just trying to become clean again. It's an ever-present reminder that we as a people, as a race, as a society, are unacceptable to God. We're sinners. We violated his law. We are left to ourselves, outcasts in God's presence. Our sin, the ultimate uncleanness, has brought about a curse upon all of creation. This is what Jesus came to do, to make his creation and his people clean again. And that's what he did for this woman. He made her acceptable, not only to the society that was around her, but he made her acceptable to her Creator. This is why Jesus emphasized her faith in him. It wasn't just her faith that if she touched his cloak, that she would be well. The faith wasn't in the garments. The faith wasn't in herself and her ability to get there and touch Jesus. The faith, her faith, was Jesus. It was the object of her faith that made her well. The same can be said about you and me. If you, like this woman, have heard about Jesus and have come to know Jesus, then you too have been made acceptable to God. And when you hear that Jesus makes you acceptable, don't think about that in terms of minimal achievement, but rather being restored to what you were intended to be. Acceptable to the point that Jesus can look you in the eyes. He can call you son. He can call you daughter. Acceptable to him because you are his. One more note on restoring the outcast. When we talk about the spiritual aspect of restoration, that's all good and well. That's what we've been discussing. But there is a practical one to this as well. This woman was not merely a spiritual outcast separated by God from God by her sin. She was a real-life outcast separated from her people and from her community. She had no one. And many of you know what it's like to be an outcast, to feel isolated from others. And the church, is as sad as it is to say, is oftentimes really, really, really good at making people feel like outcasts. So much so that the church, in order to stay culturally relevant, will often buy into the prejudices of a culture. In order to be seen as normal, we will accept and we will look down upon what the culture looks down upon so that we can blend in. Jesus didn't care about this woman's social status. All he saw was a person who was in need of physical and spiritual restoration. And he gave her everything. And it is imperative for you and for me as followers of Christ to do exactly the same. To seek both physical and spiritual restoration for those that society has cast out. And as Chris so often and so well says from this pulpit, regardless of what group is castigated in society, whether it be the unborn, whether it be immigrants, whether it be homeless, whether it be the incarcerated, whether it be the addicts, whoever ends up on the 10 o'clock news in the news story, those are the people that we need to be extending a hand to. They are the ones that the church is supposed to be reaching out to, because the church itself is made up of people like you and like me. And like this woman, outcast that through faith, have become children of God. And with that, this beautiful side story draws to a close. And this woman walks away, having found restoration at the feet of Jesus. But someone else is coming. While he was still talking, several folks, simply referred to as they, probably servants or those that work for Jairus at the synagogue, they come up and inform Jairus, pull him aside and say, "Your daughter's dead. She didn't make it." Can you imagine how crushing that must have been for Jairus? He had found Jesus. Jesus had agreed to come and to heal his daughter. He had just seen Jesus do the impossible in healing this woman. But it was all for naught, because his daughter is dead. There's nothing more that can be done. So as the bearers of the news said to him, "Why bother the teacher any longer? She's gone." But verse 36 says that Jesus overheard them. And this word "over here," it seems to directly imply that he inserted himself into a conversation that he had not been invited to. The word literally means to interject oneself when being ignored. And he tells Jairus not to be afraid, but only to believe. Jesus says this right after telling the woman he had healed that her faith had made her well. And here he is extending that same hope, exhorting Jairus to embrace that same faith. Which brings us to our second takeaway from this passage, which is that Jesus came to restore his people's faith. in the minds of us mere mortals, what more is there to be done in this situation? His daughter is dead. But Jesus tells him to cast out his fear, to ignore that earthly impulse, to accept the fate of his daughter, to accept death as a reality. Jesus challenges him to have faith. Jesus challenges him to have faith, and not necessarily faith that his daughter will be healed, but faith in Jesus himself. Faith that Jesus, as the judge of all things, will do what is right and what is just. A faith that doesn't disappoint regardless of circumstances or outcome, but a faith that casts out fear. So Jesus, Jairus, James, John, and the one guy whose name doesn't start with a J, Peter, continue on to Jairus' home. And they get there and they find another crowd gathered outside Jairus' house, and they're weeping and they're mourning. Something I didn't know before studying this passage was that these are apparently a group of professionals. Ancient Israel had people whose jobs it was to be professional mourners. In fact, a contemporary writer of this time said that even the poorest man in Israel had two flute players and a professional weeper at his funeral. And so Jairus is probably a wealthy guy. We can see this from several things in the story. And so there's probably quite a crowd gathered out here. And by the way, these people had their own guild up through the Middle Ages, the weepers. I would not have been good at that job. I would have been terrible. So don't tell you history never gave you anything. A guild of mourners. So all the J's plus Peter, they show up to this ruckus, and Jesus steps out in front of them and says, "Guys, what are you doing? What's all the noise? What's all the commotion about? Why are you crying? Why are you weeping? This girl's not dead. She's asleep." And they laugh at him. And to explain the next part, explain this laughter, remember, these guys are professionals. These aren't birthday clowns. This is the mourner's guild. I can't say that without smiling. Their job is to show up and to play sad songs and to cry when someone dies. They know the difference between when someone's dead and when someone's asleep. And by the way, that wasn't privy knowledge in the first century. A lot of times we tend to look back on people throughout history and go, "Oh, these guys were dumb. Their medical procedures were horrible." Actually, they did a lot of medical procedures that we still do today. And yeah, they did a lot of dumb ones too, but I guarantee in about 100 years, people are going to be looking back at us and be like, "Oh my gosh, what were those people thinking?" These people aren't stupid. Far from it. They know when someone is dead. And from their perspective, I'm sure that they thought the laughter was totally appropriate. This crazy teacher thinks this girl's asleep. She's dead. So the mourners scorn Jesus. And while they scorn him, the rest of the entourage, including Jairus and his wife, they go up into the child's room. You can almost feel that anticipation. You know that feeling where you want to hope something is true? You really, 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 really want something to happen, but you're almost too afraid to think about it, to hope for it, because you don't want to set yourself up for the disappointment of the reality when you're wrong. I think that's the anticipation that these two had up here. They want to see that everything's okay, but the earthly reality tells them that all hope is lost. Their daughter is laying right there. She's dead. What can a Bible teacher do? Jesus goes to her bedside. And he takes her by the hand, and in Aramaic he says, "Talitha kum." Now Mark translates this for his Greek audience as, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." But an even closer look at the text reveals that the literal meaning of "Talitha kum" is more like, "Little lamb, arise." It's tender. It's kind. It's sympathetic. It's compassionate. And this little girl who moments before lay in the room dead and lifeless arises, gets up, and she starts walking around. Now that doesn't surprise me in the slightest, because the text says that she was 12 years old. And if there's one thing I remember about being 12, it's that you do not remain in a static position for longer than you absolutely have to. This girl's alive. She's awake. She's healthy, she's 12, and by golly, she's got things to do. So she starts to play. And while she plays, the rest of the room stares in disbelief. Not only could this man heal the sick and cast out demons and calm the storm, but death itself proves to be powerless against him. The girl is alive. And we can continue to see the care that he has for her physical well-being. What does he say? He says, make sure you get her something to eat. Ghosts don't eat. Dead people don't eat. Only people who are alive eat. And Jesus cares not only for the spiritual well-being of his people, but he cares for their physical well-being as well. Get this girl some food. So we've seen the drama of the story unfold. What's the point? Why does this matter? And here's a couple of thoughts. One, Jesus cares for those who are suffering. Throughout this whole passage, we see the tenderness of his words and of his actions. The way in which he addresses the sick woman. The reassuring words he spoke to Jairus. The moment when he took this little girl by the hand and gently calls her back from the dead. And then his insistence that she be given something to eat. These aren't the actions of a charlatan or a glory hog. In fact, none of these things would have been remotely popular except for maybe those who were directly involved. They weren't done in a way in which he promoted himself. He was touched by an unclean woman who was a social outcast. And then when he was alone, he raised a girl from the dead, which, by the way, touching the dead is also an unclean thing to do. Jesus didn't do any of this for personal gain. He did it because this is what he came to do. More on that in a minute. In both scenarios, we see him encouraging and exhorting both the woman and Jairus to have faith in him. Jesus came to restore his people's faith. And here's why this is so important for us in the here and now. I ask you, what eventually happened to the woman that Jesus healed? Where's the little girl that Jesus rose from the dead? Where is she now? We know where they are. They're dead. In all likelihood, they've been dead for the better part of 2,000 years. The faith Jesus inspired wasn't merely in the continuation of life in the here and now, in this fallen creation. It was hope that he would do what was necessary to restore them fully beyond this fallen world. Because here's the deal. There were a lot of sick girls in Israel that died and were not raised from the dead. And yet the hope that Jesus brings is just as much theirs and their families as it was for the people in our story. There were many women in Israel who suffered as outcasts and suffered illness and discrimination. But the hope that Jesus brings is just as much theirs as it was for this woman. This is what I mean when I talk about Jesus doing what he came to do. And it brings us to our final takeaway this morning. This is what Jesus came to do. Jesus came to reverse the curse and to restore creation. What do we mean when we talk about the curse? We're not talking about some superstitious curse from a horror story. We're talking about the curse that humanity brought upon creation when Adam and Eve first rebelled against God and sinned. We're talking about the pronouncement from Genesis chapter 3 about how creation was changed, about how it was subjected to corruption because of our sin, because of our forefathers' sin. The creation around us even now is malfunctioning. It is not operating as intended. The things that we read about this morning in these stories. A woman with a discharge of blood lasting 12 years. That was not the original intent in creation. A little girl dying as a 12-year-old. Have you guys ever been to a funeral for a child? So one, I've been to one, and I heard it again and again and again, and it goes right to this point. People say it because I think they don't know what else to say. This shouldn't happen. We're societally prepared for people to die in old age. We expect it at this point. We do not expect for children to die as children. An old man being inhabited by demons, a man who was unable to move because of paralysis, this is not the way that we were intended to live. This is the curse manifesting itself. This is not the creation that God pronounced good. We were created to live in harmony with creation, unencumbered by sickness, pain, and death. But our sin, it brought the curse. And for us now, the curse and creation are indistinguishable. I just mentioned one aspect of that. We're societally prepared for elderly people to die. And I understand that for our mental health, there are aspects of acceptance that have to be a part of that. But, as Christians, we should not expect death to be the norm. Death is a part of the curse. It does not belong in creation. And this is what Jesus came to do. To reverse the curse, to restore creation, to set things right. We heard it in one of the songs we sang this morning. Jesus is making all things new. That's what that means. And when we read this passage, and Casey talked about this in his sermon, and it is such an important point, that what we see in these miracles, this is a foretaste of a forthcoming reality. Because what is Jesus doing in these miracles? He's showing the original audience and generations of Christians all the way up to you and me today, all who live under the curse, that the curse has no power over him. And while he was subjected to living in cursed creation, he is able to reverse it. He is able to restore it. Sickness has no power over him. Jesus restores the sick and makes them clean. Demon possession, the dark spiritual powers who are opposed to God, are unable to compete with him. Jesus restores the weak and the preyed upon. And even death itself, the ultimate power, the defining aspect of the curse in creation, the thing that daily reminds us that we live in creation subjected to futility, cannot withstand the gentle and calm beckoning of our God. Jesus restores life. Do you see what this means for you and for me if you know Jesus? Every day of your life you have lived in fallen creation, enduring the pain, enduring the suffering, the sickness, the corruption, and the death. Some of you have suffered greatly from physical illnesses, and many more of us will. You've been abused by those who should have loved you. You've been rejected by those who should have accepted you. Many of you have watched loved ones die, and death is not this noble, peaceful passing that that is so often advertised to us in Hollywood. I remember watching my grandmother die. It took 6 years because her mind was slowly being eaten away by dementia. I remember her as the grandma who used to take me on her knee and read me stories, to the point towards the end of those 6 years, she didn't even know who her husband was anymore. It destroyed her. It was barbaric. It was a fight. It was a struggle. It was a slow and it was a painful death. And above all, you've done the same to others, sinning against your neighbor, against your family, and against the one who created you. That's life under the bondage of sin. That's what living in fallen creation is like. Jesus came to restore us and to reverse the effects of the curse. That's why the Advent season is so exciting. Because he's here. He's finally come. And all those things that you've suffered and that you will suffer, they are ultimately powerless because Jesus, in his coming, in his life, in his death, and in his resurrection, has unmade all of them. That's why you can read the words that Jesus spoke to Jairus and latch on to them, because if you are a follower of Christ, they are just as much yours as they were his. Do not be afraid. Only believe. I love the Advent season because it's the moment when the curse begins to get rolled back. And yes, while these things, we've talked about that, these miracles, it's Jesus' compassion for these people, it's his love for his people, it's his heart being pulled, and he wants to help them. But it's also a greater image of what is being led up to of when he will ultimately defeat death by rising from it and giving us hope to look forward to, knowing that all the things that we suffer as a part of the curse now will not be a part of that new world. That I thought it was so apropos, the confession question this morning, because it hits right to the point of this, is that in Jesus' resurrection, we get a foretaste of what he wants us to be. That scripture verse that we see through a glass dimly, and then later on when he appears, we shall see him as he is, and what else? We will be like him. Right now, Jesus is conforming us to his image. May not feel like it. We still suffer under the curse, still struggle with sin, but all of that is coming to an end. And by the way, you know, one more quick note as we begin to wrap up this morning. It's often said that, you know, a picture is worth 1,000 words, and roughly this sermon, because I'm a nerd and I counted, was like 1,700 words. But this picture that I have up here this morning, or that was up here just a little bit ago, it summarizes this entire story in one image. And I would encourage you to take a look. If you can see up there, it's called Mary Consoles Eve. It's a Christmas card that was created by one of I think Catholic Charities put this out not that long ago. It's not an old image. What we see it is, you see Eve over here on the left. She's clinging to the apple, the image that shows us what sin, destruction, and the curse being perpetrated, a reminder of our parents' first sin. And around her leg, you see that the serpent, Satan, the curse, it's all coiled around her. It's a picture of exactly what Genesis 3 says. And where's her gaze? Her gaze is on Mary. And there's hope. There's hope. I got to say one more thing before we close here this morning. Is that I was listening to that first song, and I was really excited because Joy to the World is one of my favorite songs. And one of the particular verses, I was trying to find it recently, I think on YouTube Music, and I was looking through, and I was trying to find a song, and I kept finding, every single time I'd find a version, and my favorite verse was always taken out of it. And whoever picked that song this morning, he did the exact same thing, and I am incredibly triggered right now. Not really, no, it was a fantastic song, but once again, this verse from Joy to the World, it completely and perfectly summarizes everything that I've attempted to say here this morning. So I'd like to go ahead and close to this because it's a good reminder of the Advent season and the hope that we have to look forward to. It says that no more let sins or sorrows grow, nor thorns infest the ground. He comes to make his blessings known, far as the curse is found. Let's pray. Our Father, Lord, we are so very grateful for Jesus.